Welcome, beloved listeners, to what am I calling the program this week? Yes, Lionel. They seek him here, they seek him there. They seek Shapiro everywhere. Is he in heaven or is he in hell, that elusive Jewish Pimpernel? Apparently we've got him. Apparently he's on tonight, and in just a minute I'll prove it by saying hello, Bruce. A little later I'll be saying hello, Sarah. Sarah Chase is a big wig at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and she served as a special advisor to commanders of the international troops in Afghanistan and to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So she's well qualified, well credentialed to discuss the interlocking problems of government corruption and extremism, particularly instancing on this occasion Nigeria and what's happening in the Soviet. Then we're going to return to the subject of birds. You might remember we did a chat a little while ago about the many mysteries surrounding eggs, their incredible variety and beauty. Well, tonight we pay attention to the source of those eggs, namely birds, except that what we're going to be discussing is the strange behavioural links, the similarities between us and our avian friends. We are, it turns out, birds of a feather. Can it be true? Are you really there, Mr. Shapiro?
I have to say the phrase Jewish Pimpernel is one that will linger in memory for quite a while.
Well, mate, we missed you badly, and it's good to have you back. Look, while you've been away, the Taliban and the White House were busy negotiating the release of an American sergeant. Let's start there.
Well, indeed, the release of Sergeant Bergdahl, which is very big news. He's been held for more than 5 years, and this is now coming as the Afghan war is, from an American point of view, at last winding down, our longest war. What's interesting is that an episode that under normal circumstances would be nothing but good news and celebration has turned into a moment that combines political triumph for the Obama administration with some edgy and indeed paranoid arguments from the right. There's sort of two different lines of division going on here. One is that the Obama administration, as Israel does so often, as contending parties often do, got Bergdahl home because of a prisoner swap, sending five relatively high-level Taliban prisoners to Qatar from Guantanamo. And that has Republicans up in arms. Of course, the alternative would have been to let Bergdahl in captivity, but that hasn't stopped the criticism. And the other, which may turn out to be more culturally resonant, given the popularity of Homeland and just the general state of the world, is that, at least according to some accounts, Sergeant Bergdahl was captured. He was Private Bergdahl at the time. He's been promoted a couple of times while in captivity. May have been captured having walked off his base. He was someone with a lot of doubts, was articulating a lot of doubts about the Afghan war. And in some of the news reporting that's come out, you're beginning to see hints of resentment in some corners of the military, not in others. You know, there's a kind of an argument here. Is the principle we leave no soldier behind, or is it, well, this guy should be court-martialed? You're actually hearing that spoken. I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, I'll tell you what, Bruce, the poor fella, when he gets home, he'll be free of the tender mercies of the Taliban, but he'll be in the care of the Vets Administration, which these days sounds pretty much as bad.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. The Veterans Administration, of course, has been under fire for months, thanks largely to some superb investigative reporting by my friend Aaron Glantz at the Center for Investigative Reporting in San Francisco, who, along with some other journalists and auditors, has been revealing mounting horrible delays and problems in getting service to the vets. And this week, it all sort of culminated with the resignation of General Eric Shinseki, one of our most distinguished officers, the person who correctly prophesied that it would take 100,000 troops to even begin to manage Iraq, pushing back against the Bush administration's claim that it would be an easy war. The General Shinseki was unable to bring the huge VA bureaucracy to heel. And it's a tragedy because there actually is a lot that the VA does well. It's a center for innovation and excellence in the science of PTSD and trauma, in the treatment of missing limbs, all kinds of medical care. And yet it's had this massive bureaucratic delay with soldiers waiting, with veterans waiting 6 months or more for basic treatment.
I don't know if you saw John on the Daily Show going back over the ancient history of problems of the treatment of vets. It's not exactly new. It's been going on in the U.S., well, for war after war after war.
Well, indeed, and you could argue that the problem is war itself. The problem is compounded by our private healthcare system. I mean, the VA is actually the most successfully socialized part of the American healthcare system, and all kinds of combat veterans from World War II and Korea who otherwise would denounce socialized healthcare get their care at the VA. In many ways, it's a much better agency, both in its science and in its general care, than it was during the Vietnam era. But this country does have a long history of sending people to war, bringing them home, and then dumping them on society. You think of a word we take for granted, hobo. The word hobo comes from homeward bound veterans of the Civil War who were left to wander back from Georgia or Alabama or wherever it was, back to their homes in the North.
And I recall, of course, MacArthur actually attacking vets in Washington after the First World War.
Well, the bonus marchers. This is one of the scandalous episodes in American history at the beginning of the Depression. Vets marched on the White House to demand payments, war bonuses that they had been promised. They were impoverished, they were unemployed, and they were fired upon by troops arrested and otherwise abused.
I acknowledge, however, that doesn't excuse what's been going on lately, and it's another significant failure for Obama.
Well, it is, and he and Shinseki made a promise to reduce the delays that veterans would face. Instead, the delays are increasing, and there are reasons for it, ranging from software to corruption within the bureaucracy. There's now a lot of evidence that middle managers were cooking the books to try to make the numbers look better. It's a huge bureaucratic nightmare, and of course veterans who need health care are the victims, but it also plays into a dual Republican narrative. One narrative is Obama's not really a competent manager, and the other is that this should all be privatized, that this proves that the sort of socialized health care doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's what Obama now has to deal with very quickly.
Well, here's something else that's got to be dealt with in America, and that's because the Supreme Court has refused to hear the appeal of Jim Risen, the New York Times reporter, for refusing to name sources for his great book on the Bush era CIA.
Well, this is a really important case. Jim Risen has, as we reporters do, been protecting his sources, refusing to name his sources. And a federal court, Judge Leonie Brigham, a couple of years ago, said that the First Amendment allows him to protect his sources, but an appeals court in Virginia, the most conservative appeals court in the country, disagreed and said he must name his sources or go to jail. Yesterday, the Supreme Court, which a lot of us had been looking to, refused to take the appeal, turned down the case, which means this appellate court ruling stands, and in theory, Jim Risen could be sent to jail. This all goes back, actually, to 1972. There was a famous Supreme Court case, Brandsburg versus Ohio, in which it was declared that reporters, despite the First Amendment, despite freedom of the press, have no special protection from subpoenas and must name their sources. What's interesting now is that the Justice Department has to decide whether to force Risen to name his sources, whether to send him to jail. They can't force him to name his sources, but they can cite him for contempt and they can send him to jail. And even though the Justice Department and the people who went to the Supreme Court and said, yes, we want the right to do this, last week Attorney General Holder hinted that actually maybe we're not going to do this. And interestingly, the same Justice Department that has been so aggressive in pursuing leakers and so aggressive in this Risen case has also been supporting a federal shield law that would for the first time codify some protection for reporters in not naming sources in these cases. So there's some very complicated arguments. I think what's going on is that the Obama administration publicly wants to be seen to be pro-national security, anti-leak, and yet within it harbors a great many civil libertarians, including perhaps Holder himself, who, as we've been talking about in recent weeks, has been trying to really revolutionize the policy on the war on drugs, taking on some other issues, and now seems to be coming down curiously on Risen's side, even as officially the Supreme Court has allowing room for a prosecution. Very complicated, but big First Amendment news.
Good to talk to you, Bruce. Thanks for that. Bruce Shapiro, Tech Director, Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. And before we play a little bit of music and I introduce you to my splendid guest, Sarah Chase, a little note on China. With Tiananmen Square's anniversary minutes away, I remember that LNL went to China for a few weeks, did a lot of programs, and we visited Guo Jian's studio outside Beijing, now an Australian. He was doing confronting work and was a particular favourite of the Australian ambassador. Now I hear, or we all hear, that he's been arrested. This is absolutely absurd, and I hope our Foreign Affairs Department is jumping up and down about it. LNL on RN.